Hello, and welcome to Crosscut Talks, a podcast replay of Crosscut's live interviews with the people who shape our world. I'm Mark Baumgarten, the managing editor at Crosscut. Ask anyone who's lived in Seattle for the past few years and they'll tell you, the city has changed dramatically. The economy is booming, thanks in large part to the major tech companies now based here. This means new jobs, new residents, new construction, and a much higher cost of living. All these shifts have resulted in a host of new challenges, and few people can agree on how to address them, but somebody has to. Crosscut invited three city leaders tasked with doing just that to talk about Seattle's problems and the latest in proposed solutions. First up, Mayor Jenny Durkin. Mayor Durkin has just started the second half of her first term. Crosscut staff reporter David Croman and I both asked the mayor about some of the challenges she's faced in her first 2 years, about housing, homelessness, crime, and controversial tax proposals, and where she sees the city going in the next few years. That's part one. In part two of this episode, we'll invite two newly elected city council members to the stage to answer our questions. This conversation was sponsored by Alaska Airlines and recorded at the KCTS 9 studios on January 30th, 2020, as part of the Crosscut Talks Live series. Oh, and just one note. You'll hear the mayor tell us she's undecided about her future, but since this conversation, she's announced the launch of her re-election campaign. Mayor Durkin, welcome to Crosscut Talks.
It is great to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for coming. So I'm going to start off with a tough question. So there are rumors going around that the NHL team is going to be called the Seattle Kraken. Did you have anything to do with that?
I neither admit nor deny release the Kraken.
Well, we know that you like the name.
We do.
But it is controversial in our newsroom. The Sockeyes was the favorite. So,
a kind and gentle newsroom.
Oh. No, Sockeyes? I mean,
tough fish.
Yeah, it's
tough fish. Look how far they swim.
Yeah. So I'm here with Crosscut city reporter David Croman, and we're going to talk about the big issues facing the city. I wanted to really start off just talking to you about, these are big problems that we're facing, but we all interact with them on a very personal level. We all witness things that we wish that we could fix about the city. In your day-to-day life, when you commute to work in the morning, where do you see the problems in the city? What's your personal interaction with the challenges of the city?
So that is such a great question because I've seen this city over a lifetime. Interesting fact is I'm the first mayor in the history of Seattle that was elected who was born in Seattle. So we have always been this city that has an influx of people and change, but I've seen this city ebb and flow over years, and the change that has happened in the last 5 years, I think, has been transformational. We grew by almost 120,000 people moving here, but when they moved here, we didn't have more homes, more roads, more transportation, and so everywhere you look, we're catching up. And at the same time, the city has changed. When I was growing up here, the Central District was over 70% black. I had friends there, went there regularly. Now it's less than 14%. That's in my lifetime. And so we have seen transformational change in the city that is overnight has become more expensive. People can hardly afford to live here. Many communities of color have been pushed out. And so we not only have to fix the big structural challenges, we have to fix the bigger challenge, which is the challenge of really making sure we have a city that has true opportunity and that everybody has a ladder into the prosperity that is Seattle today.
And so, looking back, you're halfway through your first term. Looking back on those first 2 years, what do you think has improved and what has, either gotten worse or has not made the progress that you were hoping?
So I think part of the problem is that, it's great that this conversation is called the big fix because we're facing some really big challenges. And people feel it so palpably every day in whatever they do that everyone wants things fixed yesterday. And so it's been, I think the biggest challenge for me is to come in is how do we make some really big structural changes that will last a generation and at the same time address the immediate and urgent problems we have. And so we try to always track that on two different levels. And I think you still see the same issues today as when I came in. You know, affordability is the number one issue. And that has driven so many of the other issues, which is lack of affordable housing and homelessness. I'm out every day in Seattle talking to people in different communities, and you will hear it in different ways, but that's what people want to talk about. Number one, is there a place for them and their children in this city because it's become so expensive? Two, why can't we do better by people experiencing homelessness? And then how do we make sure that we harness this amazing prosperity that we have, but make it work for more people?
And can you give us sort of a preview of what the second half of your first term is going to look like?
Yeah, so I think we were able, I think largely with working with council and because of voters, we made some really big changes in the first 2 years. Some fundamental things that I think can change the trajectory of the city. For example, going to the city and saying, you know, one of the things that we know unlocks opportunity is college. And too few people can go to college and too few people can go to college without debt. And so we went to voters and said, we want you to believe in our future, double the amount of preschool, free preschool for many families, and have 2 years free college for every Seattle Public School student. 70% of voters said yes. We will tax ourselves for that vision of that future. So we've now got to make sure that that's real, that we work with the Seattle colleges so that when the kids show up, it's not just two more years, then what do? But we actually build a curriculum that's going to connect them to the jobs of the future. Then working with the great labor unions and employers in this region to say, you've got this great students coming up. We want you to hire them. Because one of the things that I hear everywhere I go is so much of this growth came on top of Seattle. It wasn't organic, and people didn't feel like they were part of that economic growth. And so I think our real challenge in the next 2 years is to build on some of the things we've done in transportation, in housing, in homelessness, and in how government works. We got to serve people in this city and make sure that people feel like they're getting their dollar out of government.
Are you going to be able to do that in 2 years? And by that, I'm asking you, are you going to run for a second term?
Oh, inquiring minds want to know. So I have no formal announcement to make tonight, but I think we can accomplish a lot in 2 years. And in having conversations with people, we'll be talking about the future soon. I will say it's no surprise that to the extent a person has political energies outside their day job, for me, those energies are going to be directed at making sure we get a new president of the United States. I'm going to be working every day, showing up to make sure that Seattle's a better place and that people can see that vision of where we're getting to.
And I was going to save this question for later, but you kind of teed it up for me. Who are you going to vote for in March?
David Croman.
No.
I'm writing it in.
No.
I have not made an announcement yet. Look, it's a really... one of the great honors of being mayor is you meet the people who come in and out, and I've had the opportunity to meet almost all of the presidential candidates. And I think that we've got a lot of choices. I'm waiting, like everyone else, to see what happens in Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina, and then Super Tuesday with California. I think we're going to know a lot more about what's happening.
So you haven't made an announcement, but have you made a decision?
I have not.
Okay. All right. So David gets all the good questions. But let's talk about what's happening right now. So we're actually on the heels of some pretty big news. So there's a bill that was introduced in the legislature yesterday that would give King County the authority to tax large businesses, raising $120 million a year, right? Up to $120 million a year. You helped craft this bill, right? Is this a game changer?
Look, it's very early, but it is clear looking at the last 2 years that a number of things are true. Number one is we know there is a huge gap between the number of affordable homes we have and the number of people that have to be housed. And it's not just Seattle, it's our whole region. King County itself, every one of the towns and cities is getting more and more expensive. And whatever report you look at, and there's been a number of them, all they cite is just this huge gap in our need to build more housing. We also know we need more revenues to deal with people experiencing homelessness, because while we've done better, we haven't been able to scale. So those goals, to a person, I think everybody shares. Businesses, labor, housing advocates, you name it, talking to people, everyone wants to get there. So the key is, how do we come together and do that in a way that is progressive, that really has revenues coming from those who can afford it most, and is really targeted at those areas where it reflects why we have this problem? So I like this bill for a number of reasons. There's a number of things that still have to be worked out. But it is progressive in that it is a payroll tax that is geared towards the people who are earning $150,000 or more. So we know from data that's what's caused this housing compression. And I've been really heartened. We've had business, labor, stakeholders, a range of people working with council at the table. It's far from done. But I think everyone knows that if we can have a regional solution to this, it would be great. And many people don't know, but King County doesn't have the authority to levy this kind of tax. They can do a sales tax. They can do property taxes. Both of those very regressive. We want to have a more progressive tax that can fund those really big needs we have. And a number of businesses have spoken out and said, look, we want to commit to the community in which we live. And we want to be part of the solution. So I think if we can bring people together around this issue, it'd be a super positive thing.
And, you know, I think there's still probably a decent amount of scar tissue around the head tax debate of 2018. Why is this going to be different? And then sort of related to that, is it important that you are sort of the one, do you think it's important for you to be the one kind of out front leading this conversation?
So I think that, first of all, it won't be successful if it's not shared. And so it won't be Dow Constantine and Jenny Durkin. It'd be the legislators. It'll be business, labor, housing advocates, a range of stakeholders who can come together and say, we think this is a solution that will help us in this very real problem. So I think the really important thing is, can we get that kind of people behind the bill? And that's what I think we're working to do. And I've had conversations with people on a range of spectrums about not just this bill, but how do we do this as a region and a city? And so I think what's different is to have that conversation in a very quiet, productive way, and really looking at what's the problem we're trying to solve, and how do we come together to do it? There's still, you know, it's the bill was just dropped this week. It will prompt a lot of discussions. But I think it's really important for us to have this conversation and to have it in a way that says, this problem doesn't stop at the Seattle city limits. This is a regional problem. And if we don't have regional solutions, we will be in trouble.
And if the bill doesn't pass, what's plan B? I mean, that being devised?
Yeah,
right now?
I think that I think it's too early to say what happens with the bill, but if we build that kind of conversation and coalition, that people are willing to have a conversation around the table with each other on how we get to the kinds of revenues we need to solve this problem, I think that's going to be a positive thing coming out of this. That people can actually agree so that we avoid some of what we had as the rancor around the last episode, and also that it's focused in a very progressive fashion and people feel good about that we're coming together to solve a problem that we've got in this region, and everybody's got to have a stake in that. Business, labor, city, county, legislators, city council. And I tell you, the thing I hear most when I'm out in the city is people want their government to work here. There's a lot of dysfunction in Washington, D.C., and people expect us to actually deliver solutions. And I think that that will be a positive coming out of this, regardless of what happens.
And you sort of made reference to some really big numbers that some folks have thrown out there. You know, McKinsey has come out a few times now and said the city may need the region may need up to, you know, $1 billion a year to solve this problem. You know, when we're looking at sort of a maximum of $120 million a year, does it run the risk that you throw out a big number that sounds big, but that in the end isn't enough to actually fix the problem?
So we won't fix the problem in any one year, but I think one thing that people miss is that McKinsey's number is the total investment that has to be made, and there's a range of what I've seen. Theirs is the upper end. But for example, I've been able to announce three different rounds of housing dollars for the city of Seattle. The city's investing about $250 million, but because we can leverage that with other partners, it will be $1.5 billion in new housing. So these monies will be able to be bonded and be leveraged using a lot of tools. So the money we get, I think, will increase exponentially if we use those tools.
And so would you be able to say confidently that if something like this was enacted, normal everyday people in Seattle would see the difference and on the street and the people that they see?
It is. It will take a while for the take up, right? Because it will be, you'll have be a year before you get the revenues, and then it takes time to build things. But I think that people will start to see, even now, because of the amounts of housing that we've announced in the city of Seattle, within 2 to 3 years, we're going to have thousands of new low-income units. And that will help alleviate some of the pressures. The other thing we have to focus on, I had a middle-income housing advisory board, you know, because the other gap we have is that working families can't afford to live in Seattle. And that delta, of, you know, for our nurses and our teachers, we want those folks to be able to live in the city of Seattle. Our middle class is our civic glue. And so we want to be able to focus on things we can do there as well.
You know, one of the things about approaching these big problems that I think is frustrating to the average person is that we can never really see what our impact is on creating solutions. We have representative government, but it's often very opaque about what our vote does exactly. So I'm curious, did the results of the November election, general election, where we saw four new council members come into power, did it impact the way that you're approaching this problem in particular, affordability and homelessness? If the election result was different, would your solution be different?
No, I don't think so. I think my approach and solutions have been the same consistently. I think that having new people in actually injects new ideas and new energy, and I'm really looking forward to that. But I think it's really important that when someone, you know, whoever is the executive, it's your job to actually find common sense solutions that make a difference in people's lives and to bring people around that. The legislative branch does that also, but that's where kind of big ideas and policies meld together. And so my approach has always been, you know, we have real challenges and people expect us to get some things done. And we can't do them quickly enough because we're just in this huge state of flux. But I think you will start to see differences. And I think government, we don't do a good enough job to show the public the progress we've made. For example, you know, when I came in, I think, you know, we'd had 1 year free college tuition as a pilot program. And there were about 125 students that were enrolled in that in the free college for 1/13th year. We've had over, I think the last count I got, over 1,100 students applied for the program this year. And it may be as many as 2,000. That may be the high limit. That will change the trajectory of the lives and community in many of these people. If they can actually go and get a degree and then get a family wage job and have a stake in our economy, 5 and 10 years from now, we'll see the dividends for that. So I think we have to do a better job of showing the people what we are doing so that they understand that it's not just futile. Because look, it's hard sometimes in Seattle. Hard to find a place to live because it's expensive, traffic seems hard, and there's that everyday sense of anxiety. And our job as government is to try to make it easier for people.
So, but you can understand people's frustration. I totally appreciate that answer. But if you're not responding to the results of an election and you're continuing on with your plan as was, can you see how that might frustrate people who went, you know, who filled out their ballot and mailed it in, and they're seeing that the mayor isn't changing course based on kind of what they said at the ballot box? I mean.
Well, and maybe I took the wrong question you're asking. Is I thought you said, would I change my approach? And obviously you change the viewpoint in terms of trying to get more voices in the dialogue, and you have new council members who have very different views about how we get to places. And so you listen to those ideas. Sometimes, you know, they're the ones who are going to lead on things. And so you always honor elections. But in terms of the approach I have, I still think the best approach is we have to identify the challenges we have. We have to prioritize them. And then we need to come together around some solutions. That doesn't mean there's not going to be different viewpoints and some great disagreements and sometimes a lot of noise. But that's okay. I mean, I truly believe that the more passionate people are, it's good because it means they still care about the outcomes. When people become apathetic, that's when we're in trouble as a democracy.
Yeah, so thanks. That's great. But there's more problems, right?
More challenges.
Challenges, opportunities. You know, and one came into sharp relief last week. Downtown, we had 3 shootings over the course of 24 hours. It's been reported that there have been emphasis patrols already downtown based on citizen requests for there to be so. What more can we do?
So we can do more of a lot of things, and we can continue to do those things that we know work. So crime in downtown Seattle manifests itself in a couple different ways, and people feel it in different ways, but they present very different problems that strategically we have to deal with differently. So first, we know that there's been, in downtown Seattle, but in other communities too, that there's a significant impact that people with significant behavioral health issues who are living unsheltered have on a community. Then in the Third and Pike area, we also had persistent low drug activity. And then on top of that, we had this gang activity. That confluence of events, each one of those things needs different strategies. And so it's not just a police response. You will see more police around there. You're going to have a mobile unit down there, police precinct, without compromising police in the other neighborhoods. But the other strategies we're doing are really important, too. In the budget that the council and I passed, we, for example, we're investing $4 million in diversionary programs for youth, really looking at youth and getting to them with credible messengers and seeing how do we change the trajectory of their lives so they don't become involved in criminal activity. We have to work on both sides. Public safety, the answer is never just arrest and lock up. And as you know, I was a federal prosecutor, and before that I was a criminal defense lawyer. So I've seen both ends of the spectrum. And there are some people where criminal justice intervention is the right thing to do for community safety. We need to arrest them, then we need to hold them accountable. But there's a number of people where the right result is just jailing people over again is the most expensive, least efficient way that we can deal with some of these problems. So we have to intervene in lives to make sure that we are changing the trajectory of them.
And as a former prosecutor and defense attorney, I mean, do you have one thing that I think we've heard a lot in the wake of this shooting is questions around sentencing, both in the city attorney's office and King County prosecutor's office. Obviously, that's not, you're not in charge of that, but do you have conversations with them? Do you think there should be more conversation around whether or not the sentencing practices of those two offices is appropriate or not?
We've had lots of conversations. When the first round of reports came out about persistent offenders, I created a task force that had judges from both courts, prosecutors from both court systems, stakeholders and ourselves to say, how do we get at these problems? Those conversations have continued. This week I've spoken with Dan Satterberg, who's the King County prosecutor, talked regularly to Pete Holmes. We have to, you know, when things aren't working, you got to try different strategies. I mean, what's that, the thing that the definition of insanity is to keep trying the same thing and expect different results? So we can't do that as government either. We've got to say we've got a problem here. We're going to tackle it in different ways. In downtown Seattle, this problem, you know, at Third and Pine, it's been like that for decades. People don't want to hear that. They don't want to hear how long it's been bad. They want to know how you're going to make it better. So we're going to be, we pulled a bunch of people together, and we're going to be taking steps to actually change what people's experience is in the downtown corridor, and not just for a week or for a few weeks, but it's how do we fundamentally shift how that feels and what's the reality down there.
And it seems like your office has not been quite as convinced that of the efficacy of the law enforcement assisted diversion program, sort of a pre-arrest diversion. Can you just talk about, you know, I know there's some conversation right now around funding that and how much it should be funded. Can you talk about kind of where you stand on that program and its health?
I'm a big proponent of diversion and have been involved in diversionary courts literally in this county. You know, I helped the original drug court, the mental health court, founded one of the first drug courts in federal court. I think LEAD is a great program. It has grown exponentially and changed greatly from its original, which was just for a few offenses and only law enforcement assisted diversion, to a much broader program, and has grown to millions of dollars. So what we're trying to do is work with LEAD to say, let's look at three things. Number one, are the people in LEAD getting the help they need not to commit further crimes? And if so, how do we measure that so we make sure the program is working for them? Two, since now about 70% of the people that they're serving are people who are homeless and experience behavioral health issues, what are we doing to really help those people long term? Because just keeping them out of jail is not going to work if you're not putting stability in their life. So how are we going to get those people shelter and or housing, and how do we get them connected with behavioral health treatment? So we're working with them to say, how does that model work so that when we do when the law enforcement officer says, look, we don't think this is jail's going to be the solution here, let's put them to LEAD, that we know exactly what LEAD is going to do. That case manager is going to work as intensively as they need to with the individual. Right now, their model is that they will work maybe 2 to 3 times every 60 or 90 days. With the change in population, that may not be enough. So we're working, hopefully collaboratively, to get a model that will work for the customers, for the city, and for LEAD.
Well, I mean, I think we're just about out of time here. But, you know, I just wanted to give just sort of one sort of closing thought. One of my all-time favorite quotes about being mayor came from Mitch Landrieu. This was around the time when Senator Jeff Flake had been sort of confronted publicly, and somebody asked the mayor about it, and he said, "That looks rough if you're a senator. If you're a mayor, it happens 9 times while you're buying milk." You know, I think there's some truth to that in the mayor's position, which is that you're close enough to people's sort of day-to-day struggles, but people see you as powerful enough to be able to do something about them. And I'm just curious to get your thoughts about the position. Why do you want this job?
You know, that the quote is so true, and I think the other part of it is not that they see you as powerful enough, but they also see you as approachable enough. I'll give you an example. I was flying back from Washington, D.C. recently, and we ended up with an airplane problem. And so as a result, we sat on the tarmac for a significant period of time. And the pilot said, take your seatbelts off. You can walk around for a while. So I was standing by my seat. Next thing I knew, literally, there was a line up the aisle, and I was having the first aviation town hall ever. And I must have talked to 30 people. Their issues range, you name it. But we have so much disconnect between people and their government right now. And it's augmented by, I think, social media and the lack of connections. I think it's why local journalism is so important, that people really understand who's serving them and how they can connect in. We finally took off. We had a divert again. And when we landed in Minneapolis for the diversion, it was very funny. The person all of a sudden, they said, you can stand up again. Two people right away. I didn't get to talk to you while we were in Washington. But I think that's great. And I think that the best thing about this job is you make real impacts in people's lives. And you see it when you sit down and talk to them wherever you are. And you see both the joy that some people have and the grief and their sense of anxiety. And it's a job that if you want to be able to lift people up and have positive impacts, there's probably no better place to do it than city government right now. I believe that cities have become the laboratory for America. If you look at the great things we're doing in Seattle, you know, people across the nation copy it. We're also the safety net for America, which creates the challenges we're talking about here today. But being that, you know, closeness is, if we can't figure it out in Seattle, then sometimes I worry about our democracy. So what keeps me going is we have a chance here to show we can do it right. And I have the incredible honor to be, you know, at the helm as mayor, and it's awesome.
Well, I know it's not an aviation town hall, but hopefully you found this experience to be unique and uplifting.
Yeah, we're the nuts.
It's bad.
Where's the fruit and cheese platter?
But thank you so much for joining us and talking about these issues. Everybody, let's give a warm round of applause for Mayor Durkin. Thank you so much.
Crosscut Talks is supported by Alaska Airlines. Alaska flies to over 115 destinations worldwide, with an average of 1,200 daily flights across the United States, Mexico, Canada, and Costa Rica. Every Alaska flight has high-speed Wi-Fi, free chat, free movies, a rotating seasonal menu, and the highest-rated customer experience of any North American airline. Alaska also tops the charts in environmental sustainability, having been ranked the most fuel-efficient U.S. airline for 7 years running. It's the highest-rated U.S. airline on the Dow Jones Sustainability Index, and it helps passengers offset the carbon impact of every trip they take. Learn more and book your next trip at alaskaair.com. This past November, Andrew Lewis and Tammy Morales were both elected to the Seattle City Council, and they were just sworn in this January, so they have some fresh perspective on the city's challenges. Andrew Lewis was elected to represent Seattle's 7th District. A fifth-generation Washingtonian, he most recently served as an assistant attorney in the Seattle City Attorney's Office. Tammy Morales was elected to represent Seattle's 2nd District. A longtime community organizer and advocate, she previously worked with the Rainier Beach Action Coalition and served 2 years as a Seattle Human Rights Commissioner. David Croman and I asked Morales and Lewis about where they think Seattle's at right now and what we should do about affordability, homelessness, criminal justice reform, and more. Okay, on with the show.
So, welcome, Council members Lewis and Morales.
Thank you.
Okay, so as a warm-up, I understand that there's always been like a bit of a competition for offices on the second floor. I remember, I think Sally Bagshaw and Mike O'Brien had a ping pong tournament to decide who got the like office that looks out over the water.
Cool.
How did you guys win your offices? Was there any competition?
We're the newbies, so we got no choice in the matter.
And so are you just given the offices?
Well, my understanding is, you know, because we're not the only new folks on the council. There are a few other, Councilmember Strauss. And I think Councilmember Peterson, now, he got the jump on all of us because he came in November. So he was able to get a little bit of a jump on us. But I think it was randomized between the three of us, between Councilmember Morales, Councilmember Strauss, and I. So it wasn't nearly as fun as the ping pong tournament.
It's not as exciting as I was hoping.
Way better.
Yeah.
I think after that there's got to be a better way than the ping pong tournament.
So it was Councilmember Peterson lording that over you? Like he was sort of like had been there a while and knew that, you know.
No? He's been very gracious.
Okay, that's good. Mike Tyson famously said, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth, right? So you both had plans. You talked about them a lot on the campaign trail. I've been in the room a number of times when you were talking about them. And then you get elected, and then you get sworn in, and then eventually you get punched in the mouth. Have you been punched in the mouth yet? And tell us about it.
Not yet, thankfully. I mean, I think we're on day 15, maybe, so there's still time. It's been great. I'm really excited to be in office. You know, candidly, I worked really hard to get here for many years, and I think that our staff is excited to work for the people of District 2 and for the whole city, and we're just really excited about pushing our agenda. We have been really clear that we want to center racial equity in the work that we do for the city and on behalf of our district. And we want to make sure that we are providing, bringing the voices of the people of District 2 into the halls of power. And that is an exciting thing for us. So we're looking forward to it.
And we absolutely encourage goofiness here. So please feel free to feel goofy.
Okay.
That's okay.
What about you, Councilmember Lewis?
So I have not to date been punched in the mouth during my time on the city council. And I mean, I would echo a lot of the same sentiments that Tammy just mentioned, that it's really been great. And to go a little deeper into, it really is, the barrier that makes sure I am not getting punched in the mouth by by my colleagues or by the by departments or whoever, is really having that impactful staff in place. And it, really the thing that's been apparent from the first month is, you get a good team, you get a good staff, people you can trust, people who bring a lot of talents to the table and can be really impactful in their work for everyone in District 7. We've laid a really good foundation with the staff in my office, Camila Brown, Jacob Thorpe, Parker Dawson, Catherine Sims. Great folks, and I encourage anyone listening to the podcast or in the audience to reach out to us to see how we can assist you, because they're on the front lines every day making sure we don't get in a situation like Mr. Tyson discussed.
I appreciate you taking the metaphor all the way through the conversation. Thank you.
Councilmember Lewis, the shooting of the other week occurred in your district. You mentioned in a meeting the other day that Third and Pine has been the way that it is your entire life. And so can you just talk a little bit about what you imagine success would look like in that corridor, and how do you get there?
Yeah, so I mean, first I want to acknowledge that in addition to the events that happened on Third and Pine last Wednesday, there were additional shootings within that 48-hour period in the heart of District 7, and that really was a really difficult week. I mean, for me personally, for my colleagues, for my staff, someone tragically lost their life, and there were many other victims, constituents in District 7. And so first I want to say my heart goes out to them and everyone that was injured. It just can't continue to go on this way, not only in downtown, but in a lot of parts of our city where gun violence is unfortunately something that we grapple with on a daily basis. In terms of what we can do at Third and Pine, earlier this week I called for a new community storefront that could be in that area to activate that space on a more consistent 24-hour basis, to have community service officers present to be a resource to folks that are experiencing trauma or not getting the help or assistance they need. I walk that corridor on an almost daily basis. I have a PO box in the building that's at Third and Union. I'm intimately familiar with the scene that's at that corner. And in addition to public safety challenges, there's a lot of public health challenges. There's a lot of extreme poverty. There's a lot of stuff that is not just going to go away with a criminal justice response, although we do need to take public safety in that corridor extremely seriously. I'm very grateful to the police chief for the increased emphasis patrols for the mobile precinct, but we need to be very impactful with our work in community building, in harm reduction, in public health improvements in that corridor as well. And, I've been meeting with the Downtown Seattle Association, been meeting with a lot of other stakeholders to focus not just on the public safety improvements, which I'm committed to, but also the community building and neighborhood development improvements, which we have plans for as well.
And Councilmember Morales, you and plenty of others have spoken about, upstream efforts, diversion, and things like that. One of the things about upstream efforts, though, is they can be sort of slow sometimes. So in the kind of short term, what's sort of a short term thing that can be done that at the same time lines up with your vision of a progressive criminal justice system?
Well, you asked about what success looks like.
Right.
And I really think that we have worked hard to acknowledge that there are many different components that need to be addressed. So we've got dozens of work groups and initiatives and coordinated council meetings and cross-jurisdictional this and that. None of that is really very well coordinated. So we have the bail reform work group, and we have the No Youth Jail work group, and we have the Seattle Youth Violence Prevention Initiative, but they don't share principles that they're operating by. They don't share outcomes. They don't share data that they're collecting and what happens with that data. So one of the first things I think we need to do is look at what resources are we spending on all these different, they're not programs, but just initiatives and convenings of people. And how do we do that better and in a way that actually moves us toward the things we want? The things we want are real investment in our community, because I do think that whether we're talking about gang violence, gun violence, building community wealth, which is something that I'm interested in, public health, which is another thing I'm interested in, it all means that we have to make the investment way upstream in order to see the outcomes that we want. So we need good schools. We need our young people to have access to high-quality, free public education. We need their parents to have good jobs with access to health care. They need housing they can afford. They need transportation that gets them where they need to go. They need grocery stores in their neighborhood so they have good food. They need access to educational opportunities. So this isn't just about the immediate response to gun violence, which I agree needs to be, we can't condone it. But we also need to be really deliberate at looking at what has caused this person to make this decision that was, for some reason, their only alternative. And I think until we start thinking more systemically and really investing in our communities in a way that creates opportunity for people, we're going to continue to see the challenges that we have right now. And in my district, this is a regular thing. South Seattle has regular challenges. We are a poor district. We were at a conversation with Alliance for Gun Responsibility during the campaign, and there was a woman in the audience who said, I grew up in Rainier Beach. In the 70s, we were having conversations about gun violence. Why are we still having this conversation? And the answer is because we haven't invested in this community. We still have schools where the kids don't have, enough food in the cafeteria. The library still has furniture from the 60s. Our buses don't run. So there's any number of ways that we could be investing in our communities in a way that could get us the outcomes we're looking for. And I think we need to have really hard conversations about acknowledging the disparity that some of our communities experience, and then committing ourselves to investing in a way that will help people move in the right direction.
Appreciate that. One of the sort of I think shining lights that people have pinned a lot of hopes on in Seattle is, as I mentioned in the last panel, the law enforcement assisted diversion program, which is it is primarily meant as a crime reduction effort, as sort of an alternative to arrest. But, that primarily deals with kind of low-level offenders. Do you think that there's a place for a program like that for people who have maybe done some more serious things? Is there a way, sure, to expand that program beyond just, low-level drug use or...
Well, so there are programs currently that, the Seattle City Council last year, before we got here, invested in gun violence intervention programs like Community Passageways and Choose 180, which Andrew worked with in his former career. And these are important programs. They are violence interruption programs that take people who have already exited the gang life, who understand that life and are really trying to mentor and provide access to opportunity for the people who are engaged in it still and looking for a way out. So this sort of, I think one of the first steps is aligning our criminal legal system so that we are clear on what our goals are, clearer what outcomes we're looking for. And the other thing is investing in these sort of alternative programs, pre-diversion programs so that we aren't just punishing people, but we're actually providing them an opportunity to make the right choice and repairing the harm done to the victim, to the perpetrator, but also to the community so that we have, you know, a chance to really rebuild the connection that we have in our communities. So I'm excited about that $1 million investment. It's not nearly enough. I would like to see us expand the kinds of organizations that are supported with it, and that's going to take more commitment from us.
Councilmember Lewis, you were, before you were elected, were a prosecutor in municipal court for the city attorney's office. Can you talk about kind of what you saw day to day and kind of that, how that informs your perspective now as a council member?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question, because I think it's important to have someone on the council that has that perspective from working in the municipal court, because we have a complicated criminal justice ecosystem that involves not just the city attorney's office, but involves probation, it involves the judges, it involves the public defender's office. And it's important to make sure that we can structure programs and incentives to make sure that folks are not ending up back in that court for repeating criminal offenses again. You know, the challenges that I've had in talking to a lot of the judges now as a city council member on the municipal court is ways that they can structure interventions to prevent the constant recidivism of certain individuals that end up back in the municipal court for committing the same conduct over and over again. And, you know, one of their limitations, I'm not going to say which judge I talked to. I'm not even going to use gendered pronouns to not narrow it down. But the judge I was talking to, they said to me, you know, they were like, you know, when I hear a lot of the criticisms of folks that come into the municipal court and they get a sentence like 15 days in jail or 30 days in jail or something that is then kind of mentioned in the press as like, you know, that was too low because this person had like 100 prior offenses. You know, this judge told me, well, if that person's 100 prior offenses are all retail thefts in the same range of like $25 to $50, it's really hard for me to do more than something proportional to that harm they've caused in the community, especially if that big box store has recovered that amount. And it's an interesting point because it's not mentioned a lot in the narrative that in the city attorney's office, and you know, I was on the front lines as a line prosecutor, we did bring a lot of those cases to trial and win convictions. But you're in a position where what is the proportional response to $50 worth of stuff that was stolen, and the judge gets to make the decision on the sentencing. And in a lot of cases, they want it to be proportional. So you're in a place, right, where the incentives are for the judge, for the defense attorney to recommend a sentence like that as well. And one thing I'm really excited about is that there's a possibility we might be able to bring back community court, which is something that we had in Seattle up until about 2015. It was a program where folks could, on a pre-adjudication basis, opt in to like probationary type supervision arrangements where they could get services, intakes, to get hooked up with providers. And that system actually worked a lot better in preventing the kind of cycling in and out of the court that we've seen more over the last 3 years, in repeating the cycle, the plea, and the closing out. You know, I think one thing that would make that more impactful is making sure that we as a city council have a conversation with the court and making sure that they have the resources to implement that, because for a successful community court, that can be much cheaper and prevent much more recidivism than spent on harsher alternatives that might cost three times more money, but still lead to that same cycle of low-level retail theft, 30 days in jail at a cost of $300 a day. You know, like for an extra $100, we could put the prolific offenders up at the Four Seasons for how much money it costs us on a daily basis to hold them in jail. And I think it's important that we note that, you know, we talk a lot about increasing our reliance on jail,
And I think there's an assumption that jail is free. And I think we always have to remind ourselves that some of these alternatives can be more effective, and they can cost considerably less. And I'm prefacing all that by saying we're talking about the municipal court. We're talking about the city of Seattle. Violent felonies are King County prosecutor, and to require a completely different approach. So I want to be completely clear on that what I'm talking about in these approaches with community court, we're talking about the municipal court, which we as city council members oversee. King County prosecutor, completely different conversation, different government, different jurisdiction. So I just want to be clear about that.
Councilmember Lewis, you brought up the idea of narrative, right? And I think that for anybody who's been paying attention to the news for the last 5 years, is that the narrative has changed, and there has been a very sort of dark narrative that has taken hold, and it has a lot to do with concerns over recidivism and a sense of hopelessness in regards to some of our fellow citizens here. Is a part of fixing the problems with the city an issue of changing the narrative to get buy-in from the community? Because it feels like some of the community is sort of like, they're never going to sign on to what you're talking about. And I guess, like, what's the approach to those who disagree with you in the city?
About what specifically? Sorry.
Convincing them.
About what?
Well, convincing.
What are we talking about?
Convincing them. Just what you were just saying. Just
Oh, like community court. Sorry.
Yes.
Sorry.
Right.
Yes.
I wasn't changing the subject, but just going deeper on that is that you're trying to sort of sell an idea of kind of like of how people should view the.
I would say that the first thing I would say is it's important that we be really clear about the distinction of what we as a city have control over versus what other regional partners do. Right. So when we're talking about prolific offenders that are in the municipal court, we're primarily talking about folks that are prolific retail thieves, right? If their behavior graduated to something where they're violent or where they've done a crime against a person that's very serious, like they would be in King County's court. So that's the first thing I would explain is like in terms of us biting off our end of the problem. We need to look at interventions that we know can work with folks that are, primarily in substance abuse-related cycles of retail theft. Now, one of the things I called for during the campaign that actually I think had fairly broad buy-in for across the spectrum of folks that are following public safety was like a municipal drug court. Now, that's something that we could do as community court instead because you could provide those kinds of services. Actually, one thing that I would tell people all the time is we have a lot of services through the municipal court that are very underutilized because we don't deliver them super well. You can go down to, in Tammy's district, the Hepatitis C project and get on medicated-assisted treatment that we know is proven to inhibit, block opioid addiction and has a really good proven treatment to try to stop opioid addiction. We have housing linkages, the opportunity to sign up for Apple Care, like lots of great services we offer through the municipal court. I think that the issue is that we're in a position where that one of the mechanisms we used to deliver that with community court went away. And there's, in a broader conversation, we could have a conversation about why the municipal court got rid of it previously. I think it's been fairly universally considered that removing community court was a mistake. And what I would tell folks is this is something we're currently not doing, and back when we did do it, things were better. So I think that would be the first way that I'd start it. I'd also preface it by saying what we're doing on our corner of the criminal justice system with the municipal court and with misdemeanors is not necessarily the same things we should be doing with felony crimes at the superior court, and that folks should contact the county prosecutor and their King County council person to try to get similar reforms and activities to deal with violent felony crimes at that county level. But we should focus on doing what's in our wheelhouse and doing it better and doing it more effectively.
Okay. Councilmember Morales, so one of your fellow council members has characterized the November election as being as there being a mandate coming out of that election. Do you believe that there's that there was a mandate delivered by the people in November?
Well, I would say that in the main, the more progressive candidates won. That includes me, which I'm very excited about. And so I do think that the result of that is that we do have a more progressive council. Some say the most progressive council we've ever had. I'm excited about that, personally, particularly because it means that we can really start shifting the conversation, again, toward centering people. And that's, I think, really important in this conversation, especially after a year-long campaign for many of us where we had to defend local government. You know, you were speaking earlier about this sort of narrative that we've all experienced in the last year about Seattle is dying and everything is dark and terrible. We're one of the fastest growing cities in the country, and that brings challenges. I don't believe that we should be looking at ever expanding growth as a goal because it affects people disproportionately and it has a really negative impact on low income folks and people of color. That said, I think that we are a city full of really bright people with great ideas, very creative, lots of strong-willed people who are willing to try new things. And I think that gives the council the latitude to take some bold steps, to make some, really strong pushes for greater equity, for the kind of growth that serves everyone, and for making sure that we're putting people at the center of our policymaking decisions. And I hope that it also gives us a little bit of latitude to try new things and possibly make a mistake, and to know that that's okay because we can fix it as long as people in vulnerable positions aren't put at risk. But I think it is incumbent upon us as policymakers at the local level, given the complete dysfunction at the federal level, that this is where innovation happens. City is kind of a lab for trying new things. And some of it's going to work, and some of it's not going to work. And we have to be okay with that. Again, as long as people aren't put in danger by that, I think it's worth trying new things so that we can serve people the best way we can and create opportunity for people. That's why I'm here, because I want to make sure that the people in my district have access to resources and wealth sharing and opportunity that has been missing from District 2 for a really long time, and it's time to change that, and that's why I'm here.
And that makes for a nice segue. I think one thing that the election did do was make it so a vast majority, almost unanimously, the city council now believes that the city needs more money to fight homelessness and housing. We're talking about the mayor before, about her proposal to kind of allow King County to possibly put a payroll tax in place. Start with you, Councilmember Morales. What did you think of that plan? Do you think it goes far enough? Would you like to do something more?
I'm really excited about the fact that the legislature or some legislators are acknowledging that we need big business to pay their fair share. I don't think that this particular proposal gets us there. It's a step in the right direction, but I think it's a really small step, and it's not a big statewide initiative. It affects King County. So I think there are some structural issues with it. I also think that knowing that, reports, studies have said that in order to address our homelessness crisis, we need $400 million a year for 10 years. This proposal gets us a fraction of that. So I don't think that the time for incrementalism, given the number of people that we have in homelessness right now, I don't think this is the time for something that's only going to get us a real fraction of the way there.
It seems like the city has tried sort of this employee hours tax or head tax now a few times on its own. It clearly has not worked. what makes you think sort of trying something like that again this time around, it might be a different result?
Well, I would quibble with you a little bit. It did work. We had a unanimous vote from the city council a couple years ago, and then we had a huge dump of money to fight that win. Which could happen again. But, you know, for me, this is really about equity. And I know I keep coming back to that. But the truth is that we know, everybody here knows, we have the most regressive tax system in the country. What this is about is fine. It's not about bashing Amazon over the head. It's not about punishing big business. It's about finding an equitable way to finance public services so that the most vulnerable people in our community get the things that they need. That is the role of local government, is to step in when the market has failed and make sure that people aren't sleeping on the streets. And we need to make sure that we're doing that in a way that's equitable. And that means that you and me don't get increased property taxes and increased sales tax every time something needs to get funded in the city, but that the largest corporations in our city also pay for the services that we need. So I don't see this as revenge for the last election or, you know, whatever some of the other narratives are out there. I really believe, as somebody who was a TA in grad school for financing public services, that we need to find an equitable way to do the very important work that the city council has to do. And I think that means bringing other people into helping pay for that.
So one of our audience members here is asking about a head tax. When does a progressive tax get so large that it turns into a penalty on successful businesses that tells them Seattle's anti-business and they should leave? I mean, this is not a novel idea. I mean, it's a major argument that's been posed against the head tax. Is there a consideration for big business, or is paying attention to their concerns necessarily have to take away from the concerns and the needs of those who are struggling?
For me, this is, as I said, this is about making sure that we have a diverse pool of revenue. And so, you know, right now we have property taxes that are capped, right? Like, there's only so much taxing authority that we have. We are hitting that limit, and our needs are still growing. And this is the challenge with government, right? Like, the resources are limited, but the needs are not. And so if we are at the cap of our ability to tax ourselves in order to fund the things that we need to fund, then we have to find another way to do this. And so it does mean asking large corporations, to contribute to the pot of money that we need in order to fund things. So I honestly, the narrative about, we'll leave if you tax us this, or like corporations say that all the time, whether they get the tax breaks they want or not. Boeing got $86 billion taxes and they still left and took 15% of our workforce with them. So I just don't think that is a reason not to do it when we know that we have a lot of things that need to
Councilmember Lewis, shortly, because we're running out of time, what's your position on that? I mean, where are you at on the head tax?
And this proposal that is now in Olympia.
Right. So starting first with the proposal that's now in Olympia, we know from a lot of reports that have been done by McKinstry, by the Chamber of Commerce, by a lot of other folks, that the scale of the problem is going to require a very large investment. I mean, there's been a lot of different numbers that have been proposed. $400 million seems to be one where there's actually a lot of consensus around it. My general position on revenue has always been plan first, revenue second. It's always been, let's be very intentional and deliberate about what our investment needs to be in the context of regional commitments, and what specifically is it going to before we implement new revenue proposals. But once we have identified those plans, and we've got a lot of groups right now in King County that are coming up with very specific plans on how we could spend additional revenue. Third Door Coalition, a coalition of service providers and businesses, have come up with some really interesting ideas around permanent supportive housing and how that could be put together. There's a lot of other groups that we've been meeting with, service providers and folks that really know the scale and scope of what we need to do. This proposal from Olympia is a really good start, and we got to be really, really clear about that, that something that's going to give us new authority at King County to assess a King County tax, right, countywide payroll tax on the biggest employers in the county. It's assessed on positions, payroll positions that are at $150,000 or more. This is a tax that's hitting the biggest employers. It's not going to be a property tax or a sales tax or another regressive tax. It's going to raise about $125 million regionally. King County, in King County, City of Seattle is going to get about $47 million or so. We were not really clear on exactly how much. The City of Seattle can do a lot for permanent supportive housing and new investments and getting the lasting support we need for folks experiencing homelessness with that much money. So I think the first thing we need to do is take stock that that's a significant move in the right direction. I think that we also need to stipulate to the fact that it's probably going to require some kind of supplemental revenue from the Seattle City Council. What that looks like, how we structure it, that's currently still up in the air. As I've said earlier, any revenue plan I am going to want to have very intentionally connected to a plan to actually scale up permanent supportive housing. We know that that's the intervention that is going to lead to lasting change in folks experiencing homelessness. Every jurisdiction from Abilene, Texas, to Bergen County, New Jersey, to Helsinki, Finland, three completely different places, Salt Lake City, Utah, four completely different places. All of those jurisdictions made significant progress on chronic homelessness through permanent supportive housing. I mean, it's not always sufficient, but it's always necessary. And it's expensive, but it, you know, muddling through this problem is going to be more expensive, more miserable, and you know, that's the conversation that we're going to need to have as a city about how we're going to pay for it. But this is a really good first step from Olympia. I am thrilled. I hope the legislature passes it. I am fully in support of it. But we're going to have to build on that.
Well, great. We're out of time. So thank you both so much for coming on and talking about these issues. I know you're at the very beginning of what will hopefully be, you know, fruitful careers working for all of us. So, thank you, Council Members Morales and Lewis. Let's give them a round of applause, everybody. Thank you so much for coming on Crosscut Talks.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This week's episode was recorded by Resty Bacall and Victoria Ralph and produced by Sarah Bernard. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. And if you like the show, please review us on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people find us. For the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. And remember to save the date for the next Crosscut Festival, May 1st and 2nd, 2020. To learn more, go to crosscut.com/festival. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Baumgarten. We'll be back soon with another episode.